It's the News Roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. Joining us this week, Anne Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Sean Corcoran, Senior Reporter and Editor here at WCAI. Good morning, Sean.
Hello, Mindy.
All right, top story of the week. Boy, what a difference a week makes, huh? The blizzard, of course, dumped about a foot of snow across our region, and we were chatting about this last Friday.
Right. Well, this was a storm that was, in a sense, like Sandy. You had two storm systems coming together, the cold system coming down from Canada, a system coming up from the south that was heavy with precipitation, came together over North Carolina, and some meteorologists are calling it a winter cane, where they had the high winds, the storm had an eye, there was a drop in barometric pressure, very much like a hurricane. It made its way up the coast, and boy, did it hit Cape Cod. Yeah. There were a lot of erosion, snow. Yeah. Power outages.
Yeah, it depends where you were, I guess, and how much snow you got. I think we got maybe about a foot, I guess, most people got, right?
Yeah, I think in Mashpee it was closer to a foot and a half, but it was the duration of the storm, mm-hmm. obviously. Last week at this time, the snow was coming down when we were, you know, doing our preview, and then it seemed like it lasted 30, 32 hours. It was certainly done in Boston before it was done down here.
And of course, we had those high winds with it. I think somebody was saying somebody clocked some winds over 90 miles an hour on Nantucket.
Right. They were saying 84 miles an hour in Hyannis, but it churned up the seas. The seas were 20 to 25 feet, and mm-hmm. there was astronomically high tides, as Sean was saying, when the duration of the storm, the high tides came in. I think it was Doug Frazier, our staff writer, who described the coast on the bay as if a front-end loader just came and scooped out the dunes. And
we're going to get into some specifics on that erosion a little bit, but let's talk first about the power outages. Worst, of course, across the Cape Islands, South Shore and South Coast, the sort of end of Massachusetts. This little southeast corner seemed to really get hit the hardest.
Right. The NSTAR has, in the Cape and Islands, about 197,000 electric customers. At the height of the storm, 130,000 were without power. It's about 78%.
So if you were one who didn't lose your power, you were really lucky, yeah. Dan Tridle.
You know. Well, by comparison, at the height of Sandy, there were 60,000 customers without power. So 78% of the Cape, it was cold. And there are still a handful of people on the Cape who don't have power.
I think it was 18 as of this morning.
Right.
18 people left.
And so there were many people who didn't have power till, you know, Tuesday, I think, was a big day. We saw it drop. I can't remember, to tell you the truth, but I remember when it went to 43%, which
right.
was still...
We're looking at that outage map and all the bright colors, and then all of a sudden it was down to yellow, which is the, you know, getting smaller
right.
and smaller, the numbers.
Right. But... So people were without power, which caused a lot of problems.
Yeah, it sure did.
It was the temperature.
Yeah.
Right.
Friday night was fairly tolerable for us without power, but Saturday night was extremely chilly. So folks I was talking to, they were saying, look, the temperature in the house got down to under 40 degrees, mm-hmm. and so we had to flee, and that's where we saw people going to some of the shelters that were opened up.
Right.
And so I visited the sandwich shelter on Monday morning, and you know, it was not a pleasant place to be in Sandwich. I think that, you know, the workers tried to make it as pleasant as possible, but it was stark. It was a very stark existence for a few days there for mostly older folks. Dennis Yarmouth, they had more people there. I think in Sandwich they had about 30 people. Dennis Yarmouth at times had almost 400 people when you count the volunteers, mm-hmm. and it was a real community feel. Someone told me a wonderful story about this couple, older couple who didn't have any other family to kind of come in and take care of them, and they at night were sitting there reading the Bible together, and it was just this great sense of togetherness in a very difficult situation. It was a very touching story.
It was really tough too for some of the folks who have, you know, the oxygen tanks that have
sure.
to be plugged into electricity. You know, I had somebody was telling me that the emergency room over at Cape Cod Hospital had, you know, was filled with folks there who just needed to get in there to, you know, then they got some of them to the shelters. Then, of course, in Sandwich, there was a problem with the generator.
That's right.
Gave out, and they had to move those folks to Falmouth. Mm-hmm. And then they opened again, and they moved them back to Sandwich. So and that can be kind of scary when you can't get your oxygen plugged in.
Well, and there's a gap there because there's people who might need the oxygen or aren't doing well health-wise, but they don't reach the level level of hospital admission.
Exactly, yeah.
And you have to be in the hospital in order to be able to get to a nursing home if mm-hmm. because by law they have to accept you in a nursing home in these situations. So there was a little bit of a gap there with people who needed a little more help but kind of fell in that middle gray area mm-hmm. and really left the people at the shelter to take care of them.
And then I was really curious why, you know, we had Sandwich, Falmouth, DY, and Nauset. Barnstable never opened the shelter there. And I was kind of curious about it. It seems like that's where a lot of people are.
Right. Why they never Hyannis opened. Was yeah. particularly hard hit and took a while to get power back as well. And we had readers who were asking us the same thing.
Yeah.
How are we going to get there? It's far away.
Right.
Maybe that'll be addressed.
Yeah. Well, they certainly had a robust program going on at Dennis Yarmouth, which isn't that far from
right.
downtown
mm-hmm.
Hyannis. And from all reports I heard, the public safety folks and all the volunteers did a great job going directly to people's homes, checking on them if they hadn't been checked on, and then bringing them to shelters, sometimes in the middle of the night when the folks just couldn't take it
yeah.
anymore, particularly sad right. that Saturday night, early Sunday
morning. Yeah, I know they had buses and things that were picking people up.
Buses and vans, yeah.
Yeah, there's a story of a town administrator, Charlie Sumner, who was helping to load people on buses to get to the shelters. But one of the things that, not to be negative here, but one of the things that also has to be looked at that some of the people who ran the shelters are saying is that there was... You know, you have a regional shelter and everybody's supposed to take turns running the shelter. I guess there's a schedule, and that schedule didn't work this time. That people didn't come. The fellow, Mr. Gallant in Sandwich, was there for 5 days,
wow.
left twice to take showers. So that's something that they're going to also have to look at, is making sure that, you know, maybe it was the snow. It's not clear.
Right.
But some people were saying that scheduling didn't quite work
didn't
out
work
this
the way
time.
I thought it would. Yeah. Well, and then, of course, we had folks who decided they'd just check out at a, you know, check into a hotel. And the hotels were, I mean, they were full.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you. So I had Friday night, I was fine in the storm. Saturday night, I was cold, but I was fine in the storm. But Sunday morning, we have a small child, and my wife was like, that was enough. If
That's
it's
it.
Not coming on, we need to get someplace warm. So we thought we'd try to have some fun with it, maybe find someplace with a pool for the kid and, you know, make a little vacation thing out. We went from Dennis, Yarmouth, Barnstable, and could not find any place to stay on Sunday. So
you had to go off Cape.
We had to go off Cape.
Wow.
Yeah, we had to go off Cape, which was fine. But,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
there were a lot of people
right.
looking for places to stay.
Yeah, no, as I say, most of them were packed. The Sandwich Shelter, as we mentioned, had to close, and there was some storm damage to one of the schools. They've been out all week.
Right.
Sandwich schools.
The Oakridge school, right.
Yeah, and they've got, so this week off, next week's holiday vacation. Those poor kids are going to have some days to make up at the end of the school year, aren't they?
Well, you know, just to step back just a little, one of the things people were complaining about with the power outage is they couldn't find out when it was going to be back
right.
on. So do I drain my pipes? Do I not drain my pipes? And you look at Oak Ridge School, where a pipe did burst. It was on the second floor of the school. Water flowed everywhere. They've got between $500,000 and $600,000
wow.
worth of damage there, and couldn't open the school. They're hoping that it will be either completely repaired or repaired enough that kids could return to school by February 25th. Sandwich High School has an emergency generator that works like the hallway lights in a power outage, the exit signs. They can't open without that generator working, so that's why they called school.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things, we're not knowing when the power is going to come back on, that was one of Congressman Keating's criticisms for the utilities, not just Enservice.
Yeah, we saw Congressman Keating. He was touring around at some of the shelters. I saw him at Dennis Yarmouth. And while Governor Patrick wasn't very critical of NSTAR, Congressman Keating certainly was in terms of communication. He said it's not that NSTAR isn't communicating. They are. They're just not communicating when individual places, location-specific information about when lights may be able to come on. To just say, okay, well, they'll all be restored by end of Thursday isn't good enough. As Ann was saying, you have folks trying to decide, should I drain my pipes because I'm going to have to leave for a few days or it's still going to be cold? Or how can I get my parents to come with me if they think, well, maybe it's just one more night and it'll be on in the morning? Mm-hmm. So that was a real problem, that lack of very location-specific information. At that same time, we heard from Governor Deval Patrick, he decided he wanted to talk about maybe it's time for the utilities to consider burying power lines as often as possible. Now, this is something that's been going on for years, and a lot of times it's local communities that decide, we want to do this for beautification purposes. Like, we're going to redo our main street, but we don't want to see these power lines. Let's put them underground when we do, you know, other when we redo the main street. That happens. But usually it is the power company that has to decide, we're going to invest in burying these lines. And so with climate change, more of these storms coming, maybe it's time for the power companies to do more to bury power lines. And it makes a lot of sense.
Well, Ann, wasn't you the one that earlier said, it seems like you sneeze here and the power goes out. And it's right. I mean, we have a lot of wind here. And,
right.
You know, and then you mix that up with, you know, wet branches and things like that. You know, you're bound to have power lines come down.
And, you know, they've been very aggressive at cutting you know, areas around the high transmission lines. I noticed, like, on Route 6, you know, a few weeks ago, it was just there's trees and then there was nothing. You know, yeah. They came through, cut it down. That's been very aggressive since they really took hits. The utility took hits from two storms in 2011 that they took, you know, too long to get power back on. And I think they were even fined for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the burying the power lines probably would go a long way because, you know, some of the things we don't see are losses to business. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to see, you know, in 6 months or so what that total was.
How do you even measure that, though?
Well,
you know?
At the Cape Cod Times, for example, because of power spikes, they kept hitting and then something would break something in the press. So at one point, the press just wouldn't work anymore. Luckily, they had printed enough papers to get, you know, cover home delivery. And it took them hours to get the press back up because when there's a power spike, it damages,
right.
You know.
Yeah, we know. Stuff. I noticed that at my house. We kept going on. We're going, what is this going to do to the, you know, the
They also lost I forget what the machine does, but it's worth about $20,000. It's
wow.
done.
Wow.
So these power spikes for businesses that were able to stay open may have lost, you know, lots of equipment.
Talking about the businesses, it was amazing, you know, because if you don't have power and you've got a restaurant open near you, boy, talk about, you know, Sunday
right.
and Monday and, you know, Sunday afternoon we were going to a friend's daughter's birthday party and they got the last six pizzas from one of the pizza places here in town because they ran out of pizza dough. Mm. 99 restaurant here in Falmouth, three nights in a row closed early because they ran out of food. They couldn't get their Saturday delivery. You went to the grocery stores and, you know, the ones that lost power, I guess they don't have generators that take care of everything. So they're loading them into these refrigerated trucks Friday night and they lost some things. And, you know, of course, some other things sold out. So you're walking in there going, wow, where'd all the food go?
Exactly.
I want to say one more thing about the burying power lines. This is something that really communities can play a role in as they move to do things like install sewers or do their own upgrades, capital projects. They need to look and say, hey, is this something we can work with the utility at the same time since we're digging these trenches, we're ripping up the streets anyway, maybe this is a golden time to get these power lines under the ground to help our community keep the lights on when these storms continue to come.
Right. And they seem like we've had so many strong storms where we've had multiple outages. At some point, I wonder if it's not going to be more cost effective
right.
to bury
right.
them
right.
for the utility. They brought 1,000 people in from Florida and Illinois,
right.
you know, North Carolina to help with, and I'm sure that wasn't inexpensive.
No, I'm sure it wasn't. And then how long are they standing around waiting for the supervisors to tell them? You
know, right. This was a criticism that
the police chief said.
In Orleans, Fire Chief Quinn said that, you know, he really appreciates that NSTAR has put these community liaison people in place, that does make things run smoother. Also that they have access to a web where they can set priorities for power, you know, what's out in their town. But he said that it was the field management that was the problem, that there were people from out of state who don't understand the grid, who can't do anything until they have an NSTAR supervisor with them. He talked about a crew of eight trucks that he saw driving around Sunday. He came back around 2 hours later and they're still there. He asked them, "Are you lost?" And they said, "Well, we're waiting for an NSTAR supervisor." We heard some, you know, more than one account of that. Mm. So he was critical of the on the ground management.
Maybe getting a little more organized right. for the next storm round. So news roundup. We're talking about the top stories of the week with Ann Brennan, assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times, and Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor here at WCAI. All right, let's get into the erosion. That was pretty severe. Let's start in Sandwich.
This was Sandwich Town Neck Beach really got hammered. And one of our, Jason Colnos did a video story. There was a lady who was showing him, you know, the dune went down to this jetty, you know, mm-hmm. rock jetty, and you had to go over the jetty to get around it. And he panned back about 20 feet. It was completely flat. So there were breaches there. There was heavy damage, you know, just the dunes washed away, breaches back into, I believe, the Mill Pond area, and lots of damage to homes.
Yeah.
One guy just bought a house
I was reading that story thinking, oh, boy, that's bad timing. He just bought it. And there were several of them that they've now deemed uninhabitable.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Just the foundations, huge rocks, you know, pieces of cement washed 50 feet down the beach and undermined further the surf undermined further the foundation and mm-hmm. and soil underneath the house. So we saw several things. I think in Sandwich and Brewster that almost about 90% or more of the stairs leading to beaches mm-hmm. were destroyed.
Yep.
We saw similar things on the Outer Cape.
Yeah, Graham Geis, who's he's the guy that's been studying coastal erosion for many, many, many years here. He's the director of the Land-Sea Interaction Program at the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies. And one of your, I think this was in the Sandwich article, he's quoted as saying how surprised he was that there was so much erosion. And he was saying that he believes they were thin without a heavy buildup of sand that would have absorbed a lot of force of the storm waves and protected the base of coastal dunes. The beaches being thin because we've had some of these, you know, we had
right.
Sandy and we've had some sort of, and these beaches haven't had a chance to sort of, you know, naturally fill back in.
You know, I think it was in the 1980s, I can't remember what year, maybe the late 80s, that the first Chatham breach happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 2007, the second, creating the north and south beaches. Now we have a third breach on the southern end of South Beach is what it's called now. It just goes to show that, you know, over the years, these storms have been wearing away parts of our coastline.
It was George Price, he's the superintendent of the National Seashore. He was saying that 10 years of erosion occurred in this one storm on the beaches out there on the Outer Cape.
Yeah.
There was one guy on the Cape Cod Bay side, I believe it was in Wellfleet, who measured his frontage to his house to the beach, I guess it was a cliff, dune, was 14 and a half feet. At the end, he had about 6 feet left.
Wow. Well, that's scary. So, well, going back to Chatham, we had, of course, we've heard a lot about those cottages that were on North Beach, and one of the six tipped over in this storm. I was surprised only one, and you know that was the least of the damage. Just you know, thinking about where they're sitting,
and that's the concern that George Price has been talking about. That's why he's been pushing to get these cottages removed now. And it's obviously controversial; they're owned by people, but he's saying you do not want these things going into the sea and just spreading debris all over during a major storm. That's why he wanted to get those removed, and obviously that hasn't happened. But in Chatham, you know, the South Beach, the extension of Nauset Beach there, you know, it's been getting narrower and narrower, and so this breach could turn into a new inlet. So if we want to be a little bit positive, okay, mm-hmm. it's a large breach, and it's not really too concerning for the housing and different infrastructure there because of its location. There are some questions about maybe some shell fishing impacts, mm-hmm. but generally boaters be like, oh wow, we can go right out this way. Don't have to go all the way around. So
there might be,
yeah, and that's pretty positive. Treacherous water, I understand, going around Monomoy. So.
Yeah,
they're saying that.
Yeah, and then, of course, we have the East Ham beaches, which were hit hard, some of the seashore beaches as well.
Yeah, Coast Guard Beach in East Ham saw a lot of erosion. Footage in Brewster and East Ham just just eaten away. Lots of stairs and access. Newcomb Hollow Beach is one of my favorite beaches out there. It's at Truro, Wellfleet. I'm not quite sure. It might be Truro. The access, just the pathway is now pretty much gone. I guess it's essentially a cliff. Yeah. I saw one of the TV guys trying to negotiate it, and it almost ended up on a blooper reel because it wasn't easy.
Well, our out-of-Cape correspondent, Brian Morris, did a report on Monday for us on some of the erosion out there. And I think he was at Coast Guard Beach, and I can't remember what the other beach was he was at, but he sent along a little video, and it was like really amazing to see what the beach looked like after the storm. It's just, it's hard to imagine that much sand, you know, in one storm, being taken off.
And they're warning that those cliff, you know, the dunes have the physics of a dune is that they want to be kind of more of a hump than a cliff.
Right.
So that it's extremely dangerous to be either walking around the top of or the bottom.
And fall
because
right
they're already shifting.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so people should be very careful if they're around those.
And then, of course, there's
dunes.
Concerns about all the dune grass that's
exactly.
That you don't want to be trampling on and all that.
But a great story in the Cape Cod Times about those students going out with pieces of board. Explain that to us, Anne. That was interesting.
So what they've been doing is, I think it's mimetrics is what it's called. And they take little slats of wood and stick it in the sand where at Ballston Beach there was a breach that sent seawater into the Pamet Valley. So they want to try and fix that dune. And what these – they do a whole like grid of these slats that stick about, I guess, a foot up out of the sand. And they act like seagrass. So it catches the sand and it allows the dune to rebuild. They had a project – these students helped – put all these slats in. I believe it was Tuesday or Wednesday, and they had done that previously in a dune further down the beach that had breached at Ballston Beach, and it brought it back. And that dune, in fact, survived the storm.
Oh, isn't
so
that
they're hoping that you know by putting they've done Christmas trees before,
right.
I know, but by putting these slats in, it mimics the grass.
Well, that was the other thing on the list: the dunes at Ballston Beach washing over the waves, and that mix of salt water into the fresh water. It's going to could change that whole ecosystem there.
And it happened, it just so happened, like Eric Williams just was in the area and caught it, you know, at 10, with the high tide on Saturday at 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of damage at 10 a.m. on Cape Cod. It just came through. And so they're hoping that this dune, because getting the salt waters into the marshes, freshwater marshes, makes things more complicated.
Absolutely. And we also saw flooding and erosion on Nantucket, as expected, you know, some of those beaches on Nantucket and downtown. Seems to get some flooding downtown anytime there's a big storm there, but no real damage. And the vineyard didn't seem to fare too badly. You know, didn't hear of any really bad erosion problems there.
Right, yeah. Right. Nantucket did well with the power, too.
Right.
And Martha's Vineyard did well with power for a while until they had
it was
a transformer
was sort of the, blow. Yeah, the end of the storm. I mean, it was.
I think they're probably still assessing.
Right.
There was so much in erosion that I believe they're still assessing it. I don't think we really know the full extent at this point.
Right. And we talked about it being Atlantic beaches, but as you were saying earlier, Anne, homes along Cape Cod Bay also saw that tidal surge. And as you're saying, the shoreline completely changed in many areas there.
Right. Like, just scooped out that person I talked about who measured their frontage from their house going from 14 to 6 feet. A lot of, like, I think it's 90% of the stairways in Brewster. Again, you saw houses, the foundations are undermined, and just tremendous damage. Like I said, I think they're still assessing.
Right. And then, of course, there is money available to help with storm repairs, but you better move quick.
Right. Because of the emergency declaration, there are funds available, but you have to have your application into your town's Conservation Commission today in order to be able to bypass any permitting. That usually you'd need a permit to replace your stairs or your foundation. You can do without a permit today, and then money's available as well. If you do make today's deadline, you have to finish the work by March 8th. Mm-hmm. A lot of people on the Cape are saying, wait a minute, we didn't know about this.
Right.
They found out about it by accident. Mm-hmm. Senator Therese Murray was here yesterday touring the Cape. She was saying, I'm going to try and get an extension on that because people's power was out.
Right. That, they don't know
and
about
people
it,
didn't
yeah.
know about it. There was no, I certainly didn't see anything come across, our information. So DEP yesterday said they don't have any plans to extend it, so we'll see what happens. But if you do have damage and you want to bypass the permitting system
get
and be available for emergency funds, you need to get to your conservation commission or go to your town hall. I'm sure
and
they can help
them,
you.
Yeah, what you need to do. And like you said, they're still assessing the damage, you know, so it's
right.
like you may not exactly know what repairs you really are needing at
well,
this
and
point.
Part of the reason they're assessing it is there's so many second homes on Cape Cod.
Right.
There are people from out of the country, from right. different parts of the country who don't, you know, who aren't here or who haven't made it back here mm-hmm. to see what their damage was.
Right.
So that's part of the problem. And the conservation commissions now are under pressure to process all these on a timeline. So,
yeah, with all the damage, you can imagine there's a lot of people having to do some work.
Well, it's also worth noting that during the storm and after the storm, there was a real sense of community in a lot of these neighborhoods.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes.
I had folks call me up, you need wood, you know, and I had saw the neighbor going to check on the seniors, the older folks who live alone. So there was a lot of that. And going to any breakfast place when the when the lights were out, not only was there a lot of bedhead, there was a lot of conversation about how what can I do? Can I know some guy who might be able to come over and help you with this and that.
Right.
So
that
was
it's funny.
Really
inspiring. Had somebody yesterday tell me that they had their power back pretty quickly, and the family went out to dinner, and he was saying how you look around the restaurant and you could tell who the people were but still didn't have the power.
But
they're plugging in their phones, and
it is really heartening to see people pull together in a time like this.
Sure.
And that just really is kind of the natural reaction of, okay, I've got this. What can I do to help other people, bring us together?
Exactly.
And
then, of course, the storm also brought in some seabirds that got caught in the winds.
Yes, puffins.
Yeah.
And some others. But these were two puffins that were found and taken to wild care for recovery. They were a little dehydrated. They, from what we're told, birds aren't really built to fly at 70 to 80 mile an hour winds. They were blown in. And so they're being nursed back together. They also had a peregrine falcon that they found.
Mm-hmm.
Some other seabirds.
Yeah, I looked at that video, and those little puffins are so darn cute. It looks like a stuffed animal. I mean, they really are. Now, I was talking to Vern, and he was saying that I think it was Blair Nikulov, saw 54 of them flying over Skagit Beach. I think it was on Sunday.
Right.
Yeah,
about 50 puffins on Sunday. And Vern Locks, he just had the best quote in the paper. He said, he compared these puffins trying to fly during this blizzard as if they were trying to fly in a washing machine, so they're not built like that. And if you can't picture them, they've got these, they're called the parrots of the sea, and they've got these multicolored beaks. And as you say, they look like little stuffed animals. And
so
the birders were happy.
Yes.
Well, yeah, happy that they're being able to, they could see a lot of birds, and now they get to move on once the storm moves out. So
I never knew that they were part of the penguin family.
Yeah. See,
they're very cute. Yes,
something new every day.
There was a very pretty Merganser duck as well.
Yes,
that
was very
that they had.
Yeah, exactly. Ann Brennan, assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times, and Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor here at WCAI. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.